Back in 2013, I taught a class here at UCF on building your own theology. And this idea that you can build your own theology as opposed to ascribing to a pre-existing theological system designed in the past or by someone else is deeply connected to what we mean when we talk about Unitarian Universalism as a theologically liberal religion. And I should add that when we talk about UUism as a theologically liberal religion, that does not necessitate political liberalism. Both historically and today, and I've talked about this in the past in sermons, it is possible to be a religious liberal and a political conservative, or a religious liberal and a political liberal. Irrespective of one's politics, when we talk about the liberal turn in religion, that talks about the move from religious authority being vested in hierarchy, what someone who's a religious authority tells you you're supposed to believe, or religious authority vested in community or tradition. You know, it's what everyone else believes or what we've allegedly always thought. So it's that move, the liberal turn is the move from that to religious authority vested in human reason, what makes sense and what's logical and what's consistent, as well as in personal experience, what I know to be true firsthand because I've seen it for myself. And that was a major shift. And again, this liberal turn is not in the modern sense of an orientation toward the Democratic or Green Party. Rather, it is liberalism in the classical sense from the Latin root liber, meaning free. So historically, you can see this liberal turn in theology toward individual freedom of belief beginning in the 18th century with the Enlightenment. And practicing liberal religion means being free to build your theology based on what you know to be true, based on reason and your firsthand experience. And we've seen the fruit of that turn to liberal religion borne out as individuals and groups have won hearts and minds for greater equality with the truth that regardless of what infamous passages of ancient scriptures that are racist and sexist and heterosexist, regardless of what those ancient passages that are infamous, sometimes called the clobber texts, they're the texts that people pull out to beat each other up with. So regardless of what those texts say, people found that in their firsthand experiences, they began to see that slavery is wrong, that women and men are equal, that same-sex relationships are just as hard, difficult, beautiful, and significant as heterosexual relationships, and just as deserving of all the same advantages and protections under the law. Liberal religion means not being locked into antiquated belief systems simply because it's allegedly always been that way, but instead embracing the freedom to build a theology and ethics as new information comes to light. This fall, I taught a follow-up class here at UUCF. So after building your own theology, we did building your own ethics. And we discussed, and instead of memorizing pre-existing ethical systems, we discussed various ethical dilemmas and case studies. And in particular, the curriculum challenged us as we moved through these diverse ethical dilemmas to be attentive to the following questions. And as you listen to them, you can think about how you tend to respond to various ethical situations or be attentive in the future to how do you respond when you hear about things on the news or in people's lives? How do you respond to ethical situations? And Bob talked a little bit about this earlier. Are you consistent in your ethical approach to each case study? Why or why not? And is having a single ethical approach to all situations, is that a virtue or might that be a vice? Second, is there a pattern underneath your responses to ethical situations? So I encourage the members of the class to keep a journal and to kind of make notes about how they were responding to the various situations. And to notice, do you see yourself going first to logic? Do you see yourself going first to your heart? Is it first to your gut or some combination? And what does that mean? Is there a pattern behind why you respond differently or does it tend to be the same? And how might you balance your ethical responses? And third and finally, do you find your opinion changing because of points raised in the discussion? So over time, as you listen to different points of view, do you change your mind or do you decide and then the book is closed? And is that a virtue or is that a vice? Paying attention to these dynamics can help us be more intentional about building our ethics. During the spoken meditation, again, you've already heard some reflections from members of the class of insights that they had about building their own ethics. And in the sermon, I'd like to share with you some of my perspectives. At the outset, I would emphasize how central this perspective is to Unitarian Universalism. To quote the words of a former president of the UUA that we often reference in our new member ritual, "The memory that we as UUs, that we seek to embody, is of forebears wise enough to set aside the creedal questions of what do we believe in common." Because we discovered that we couldn't settle that there would be no ending to trying to settle what we believe in common. So instead, we began to substitute the far more profound covenantal questions of how shall we treat and help one another here? What hopes might we share? What promises can we make to deepen one another's lives in the short time that we have here together and on this earth? Said differently, we UUs believe in deeds, not creeds. And being intentional and responsible about ethics is vital if we're going to maintain right relationship with one another and with this earth amidst all our diversity. Emphasizing the need to build your own ethics is also important to me, but it's because it is so clearly the situation that we find ourselves in 15 years into the 21st century. Does that ever boggle your mind a little bit, that we're 15 years into the 21st century? So to me, the need to build your own ethics is so clearly the case, given all that we know in the early 21st century. But I was raised with a very different perspective, and I know some of you were as well in different ways. For me, the theologically conservative, so as opposed to the theological liberalism I've been talking about, the theologically conservative religion of my childhood taught me that Jesus is the center of history. That literally the history, the metaphysics of the entire universe changed with the life, death, and resurrection of this one peasant who lived 2,000 years ago. That was how I was taught to see the world. But as I grew up and I learned more about science, I began to continue to have a deep respect for the ethical teachings of Jesus, and I continue to have place a deep value in many of the spiritual teachings and practices of the Christian tradition. But I also began to have a much greater appreciation for the overwhelming scale of our 13.8 billion-year-old universe. And that after Copernicus, after Einstein, after Hubble and others, we know that neither Earth nor Jesus is the center of the universe or history, but rather Earth is just the third rock from the sun in a solar system that is merely on the periphery of that spiral galaxy known as the Milky Way, that in turn is only one among more than 100 billion galaxies in the universe. What Carl Sagan used to say, it's about billions and billions. And after Darwin, we know that our species is not a little lower than the angels, but merely a little higher than the apes. Here in the year 2015, we know that no ethical system, we know too much about history and anthropology and the great pluralism of the different cultures around the world, that we know that no ethical system is handed down from on high to be applicable to all times and places. Instead, we know that all ethical systems are contingent on time and chance and historical context. And to me, that makes being intentional and responsible about building your own ethics all the more vital and important. The person who has helped me the most in reflecting on how I might want to go about building my own ethics is the late American pragmatist philosopher Richard Rorty. I first read his book, Contingency, Irony, Solidarity, well more than a decade ago. That's not necessarily where I'd tell you to go to start. You might want to go to his book, Achieving Our Country, or he's got a book of essays called Philosophy and Social Hope. You could kind of read first the essays that most interest you if you're interested in learning more about it. But the one that first hooked me was Contingency, Irony, Solidarity. And although there are parts of his book and his philosophy that I disagree with, that basic three-part movement has really stuck with me. In the first two parts, I really appreciated and wrestled with his sheer honesty about the radical contingency of our historical context that we've reflected on already. So contingency and irony. The fact that we live after Copernicus, after Darwin, after Freud, and realizing how infinitesimally small we are in the grand sweep of the universe. And the appropriate response to me is humility, being humble, a little more humble in our perspectives, knowing how infinitesimally small we are. But then here's the twist. We can choose solidarity with one another anyway. We don't have to, and there's no guarantee that we will, but we can. And despite all the terrible things that we have done to one another as human beings, and all the things, terrible things that we continue to do to one another and to this planet, we as a species have chosen solidarity and compassion, dignity and decency many more times than we might have, or that one might have guessed looking at human history. And one of Rorty's major turning points, major points, is emphasizing that there is no neutral, non-circular justification for whatever ethics we decide to build. By that he means that whatever ethical systems we come up with are deeply shaped by time, chance, and historical context. There is no one right way of acting ethically in all times and places. We are again but one species on one far-flung planet that is on the edge of one galaxy among more than 100 billion galaxies. The implications of such a realization does not have to be despair at our insignificance. Rather, it can be seen as an opportunity to embrace the preciousness of this life, that we are here right now, despite all the twists and turns of time and chance that led to this one moment right here and now in the 13.8 billion year old universe story. For me, the hope of this evolutionary perspective is the challenge to let go of fundamentalist perspectives, such as the one that led to the barbaric atrocity this past week in France. Instead of an evolutionary perspective, many traditional religions, not just Islam, but many other traditional religions maintain, not always, but in some parts, maintain a pre-Copernican, pre-Darwinian worldview that teaches that individuals must make sacrifices in this life in exchange for rewards in the next life. Sometimes this is called fire insurance. But Rorty writes that... Rorty writes that willingness to endure suffering for the sake of future reward, that it turns out that is transferable from individual rewards to social rewards, from hopes for paradise to hopes for one's grandchildren. I find that shift to be an incredibly beautiful promise. The willingness to endure suffering for the sake of future rewards, that is transferable from what we hope to just get for ourselves to hope for all beings. From one's hopes for one's own life in the next world to one's hopes for the world that we are creating right here and now and leaving the legacy we are leaving for future generations. Let me be clear that by no means am I saying that I can prove to you right now whether or not God exists, whether or not an afterlife exists. Rather, what I'm inviting you to consider is that from our finite human perspective, we will never be able to answer metaphysical questions with certainty. So while metaphysical questions may remain fascinating to speculate about, why not focus the best of our energy on what we know we can do, building a better world right here and now on this earth, for ourselves, for the people that are here, and for future generations. This spring, I'm co-teaching a course at Wesley Theological Seminary in D.C. on Unitarian Universalist history and polity. So I've been thinking a lot about how we frame the stories and how we tell the stories of how did we get to our current present situation. So this morning, I've been attempting to give you a brief example of what it looks like to tell our story, to tell the story of how we theological liberals came to believe that human reason and individual experience were vital and legitimate sources of religious authority, how we came to see Copernicus and Darwin and Einstein as equally important for building a theology and ethics as Buddha and Jesus, as Moses and Muhammad. And I would like to move toward my conclusion for this morning by reflecting some on the story that we better need to learn to tell if we are going to more fully transfer our hopes from individual salvation in this world or the next to the social hope of how we human beings, we clever animals, might learn to be together in this world. Part of the promise here is the invitation to tell this story of social hope in an inspiring way, even in a patriotic way. Rorty writes that this might mean acquiring an image of ourselves as heirs to a tradition of increasing liberty and of rising hope. wanting ourselves and our children to come to think of ourselves as proud and loyal citizens of a country that slowly and painfully threw off a foreign yoke, freed its slaves, enfranchised its women, restrained its robber barons and licensed its trade unions, broadened its religious and moral tolerance, and built colleges in which increasing percentages of its population could enroll. A country that numbered Jefferson, Thoreau, Susan B. Anthony, Eugene Debs, Rosa Parks, and James Baldwin, among many others, as among its citizens. This narrative of freedom and hope is one we can learn to tell better, more boldly, and more robustly if we're going to create a solid, more solid foundation for working for social hopes and social justice. Wordy continues by noting that few people at the turn of the 20th century, so thinking back more than 100 years, few people at the turn of the 20th century would have predicted the progressive movement, the 40-hour work week, women's suffrage, the New Deal, the civil rights movement, the successes of second-wave feminism, or what we are seeing today in legalized same-sex marriage in 36 states and the District of Columbia. Nobody in 2015 can know that America will not, in the course of the next century, witness even greater moral progress. Related to how we might contribute to that progress through our connection to the larger UU movement and beyond, every other year, delegates to the UU General Assembly select one issue. So there's so many things we can work on. So we force ourselves as a movement every 2 years to select one issue that we will focus on for the next 4 years. And we call it a Congregational Study Action Initiative, or a CSAI. We love to abbreviate everything. And so the CSAI we voted on last summer in Providence, Rhode Island, is escalating inequality, so the wealth gap. You'll be hearing more soon about how we can participate in that current CSAI on escalating inequality. But for now, as we reflect on what role we as individuals and we as a congregation may feel called to play in advancing the causes of social justice in our time, I'll leave you with this reflection from Rorty from an essay. So we talked a little bit about what it was like to look back on these phenomenal, unpredictable advances in the 20th century, despite all, of course, the horrors of the 20th century as well. What might it be like to look like, to think about what it may be like for our future generations to look back on our time and the work that we are doing and may yet do? So he's imagining, what would it be like to look back from the turn of the 22nd century? He writes, just as 20th century Americans had trouble imagining how their pre-Civil War ancestors could have stomached slavery. So that's us. That's what we think. So we, at the end of the 21st century, have trouble imagining how our great-grandparents, that's us, could have trouble imagining how our great-grandparents could have legally permitted a CEO to get 20 or more times her lowest paid employee. We cannot understand how Americans 100 years ago, that's right now, could have tolerated the horrible contrast between a childhood spent in the suburbs and a childhood spent in the ghettos. Such inequalities seem to us evident moral abominations. But the vast majority of our ancestors, that's us, took them to be regrettable necessities, which is what our ancestors said about slavery in the 19th century. There is no guarantee that the arc of the universe will bend toward justice, but may we do our part in working for what our sixth principle calls the goal of world community, with peace, liberty, and justice, not just for a few on the top end of that escalating inequality, but peace, liberty, and justice for all human beings. Together, may we work to build a future with hope.